Chapter 1. Day 1. 10 days ago, 4:50 p.m. International Security Task Force, ISTF headquarters. Watergate House, London. Calla stretched her palm across the electronic reader and connected to an invisible database terminal. When she touched it, it displayed an image of her palm. Tiny bolts of light danced around the edges of the device, spinning as if waiting for a signal. Identity. What a funny thing. This was her ISTF identifying procedure. The machine made a beeping sound and a green light came on. When Calla looked up at the security guard, he was smiling down at her. "There you go, Miss Calla Kress," he said, studying her. "Cultural agent. Code Green Sparrow." If Calla had cared less about trying to get to the Q archives that evening before the closing time, she would have given the man more attention and hoped this ISTF gathering would be a quick briefing. His eyes were still on her. "Says here you're registered with a standard-issue ISTF agency firearm. Please leave all weapons here before you go into the next room." Calla studied him. He was guarding an organization he didn't know anything about. All intelligence, but not all knowing. She watched him like a hawk, still and silent. Calla had never been in this part of the ISTF building, the wing reserved for admitting members with high clearance. The secret organization was careful who it let in and when, especially when it needed expertise from specialists. British Museum curator in charge of the Roman and Byzantine antiquities, Calla was here as a codebreaker for ISTF. ISTF briefings were on a need-to-know basis and her credentials didn't spell out spy. She searched the man's face. "I don't have a weapon. I never carry a gun with me. It might just go off." He smirked. "Isn't that the whole point?" Calla grimaced, walked past him and continued down the hallway and into the special room. After 3 years of working for ISTF and helping to break codes, she'd become a field agent. A non-gun-carrying one. The message last night had been urgent. All it said was to show up at 5 p.m. Her British Museum curator credentials had earned her a seat in this congregation. They were looking for analysts, codebreakers, you name it. Calla just hoped she didn't have to read codes tonight. Not tonight of all nights. She moved into the high-tech room. The seats were set in a circle, and there was a podium in the middle of the room. Dark with no windows, Calla passed a row of chairs before proceeding towards the back of the room. In front of her, an electronic reading device waited for her thumbprint. She slumped into her seat and pressed her thumb on the reader. More people filed into the space as the ISTF board chairman tugged at his collar. He scanned the conference room as participants took their seats one by one. 30 people crammed in the 20-seater space. When the lights dimmed, Calla glanced around the room. The podium, surrounded by several chairs, made the meeting mimic a Prime Minister Cabinet Briefing Meeting Session, or COBRA. International scholars and police officials, plus analysts from five nations, waited as they compared notes. As they examined the photographs projected on the presentation slides, they questioned the validity of the top-secret ancient manuscript that took form on the tablets before them. Voices murmured in disagreement. Calla observed and listened. "Please settle down. We've got an hour for this brief," the meeting chairman said. "Several of you will get a turn to articulate your thoughts on the Hadrius manuscript." As Calla flipped through the briefing notes, she encountered a photo of the manuscript. The central part of the manuscript was two-toned and covered with black and burgundy text. The thick script-formatted lines traced over every surface of its tattered pages. The chairman moved to the next slide. Calla guessed most of the onlooking faces coveted a seat within Task Force Carbonado. This was an ISTF group that would work with the manuscript's decryption. The chairman continued, "After this meeting, we'll select a special task force called Task Force Carbonado to investigate the manuscript's authenticity and lead some of its retrieval efforts." A woman interrupted him. "We rarely investigate cultural heritage crimes, so why are we looking into this one?" He winced, his facial muscles warped into a grimace. "We are unparalleled in our intelligence, and we have connections that go far and wide. If we don't get to the manuscript, the wrong people will." The Hadrius has resurfaced in Berlin after it disappeared over 50 years ago, so we must act now. Still, the woman said. ISTF's aim is always to prevent a crime of any sort, even though our most recent endeavors linked to cybercrimes and crime linked to new technologies, he replied. By now, she asked. The Hadrius's black market worth alone makes it a valuable artifact and therefore a potential criminal target, he replied. Excuse me, but surely the German government can tackle this on its own, a French researcher said. The chairman's eyes dimmed. Calacres, artifact specialist for ISTF, can explain more. All eyes fell on Calla, and she drew in a deep breath before responding. The Hadrius is a historic cryptic manuscript. Some think it's an ancient letter. Others say it's an instruction manual. The Hadrius family, whose ancestry goes back to Cheshire in northern England, first discovered it in 1879, just off Britain's shores. Correct, the chairman said. Research we commissioned to experts in this room suggests that it details the whereabouts of potential resources that will make crude oil seem like dinner leftovers. Believe me, ISTF needs to get to this first. Our efforts will reap significant economic value for our five governments and the globe. How's that? Interrupted a Parisian. There's even skepticism here whether it is authentic. We can't read it. The chairman pinched his lips together. There are about 1.3 trillion barrels of oil reserves remaining in the world's major fields, which at present, rates of consumption will only last another 40 years. Our resources, miss. Pascal. His eyebrows drew together. Miss Pascal, we believe the document was encrypted to hide certain resources and secrets ISTF needs to know. The light at the end of the Hadrius Enigma could add several hundred years to that figure. As you know, the rising cost of oil, gas, and other natural resources has now forced global governments and energy companies to look at exploiting new resources. But we'll delve into that in a minute. He searched the room. Was he looking for more cynics as the gathering quieted? None attempted to challenge his perspective, and they waited with silent nods for more revelation. The Hadrius manuscript, like many unexplained artifacts, had plagued Calla's mind. She squinted as the chairman drummed the podium and waited for the noise to settle. His voice rose. After today, we will make nominations for the mission. Over to you, Chester. Chester Hitchens, an animated Bletchley Park archivist, marched to the presentation stand. A screeching noise fed through the sound system as he adjusted the microphone, lowering it to his short frame. With unsteady fingers, he straightened his thick glasses. Though he spoke with eloquence, he paused short of a stammer after only a few breaths. The Hadrius manuscript, printed on vellum, first came on our radar in 1962. The government sent anonymous images of the first two pages to the museum for validation. We do not know who sent them. Although we couldn't establish the nature of the writing nor its contents, our archivist declared it to be a manuscript defying all decipherment. Chester's eyes narrowed and spots of red darkened his cheeks. God help us if it isn't a fake. Calla fought a throbbing in her chest and wiped her brow as a scholar's voice sounded from the audience. The language on the Hadrius looks like Voynich's own lettering. Why did they compare this document with the Voynich manuscript? The Yale University-owned document had baffled many linguists and cryptographers for decades, and she doubted they would reach a conclusion in this forum. But has anyone seen it? Touched it? Asked a bearded Russian professor. The chairman stepped in front of Chester and spoke again. There will be many opportunities. ISTF has the duty to do whatever it can to diminish the threat of terrorists using looted art to finance crime, and they will take advantage of the situation. Calla's throat closed up as the debate continued. Seated close to the back door, she searched her notes, then passed a hand through her hair. The clock above the projector read 5:50 p.m. 10 minutes. She worked in a museum, for crying out loud. These government intelligence gigs were just for amusement and a lucky chance to hang out with her intelligence friends. Calla half listened and glanced around the room. Where was Allegra? She was a key ISTF board member. Why would she encourage her to come and not turn up? The noise level in the room rose. A second presenter from Munich left the podium, having offered no new insights on either the Voynich or the Hadrius manuscript. None had laid eyes on the Hadrius since the 60s, those who had couldn't describe it fully. Calla bit her lip. Even the low-resolution photos showed only three images. The British analyst stood. Order. I'm not finished yet. We must consider the implications of the Voynich script on the Hadrius project. We don't know that. The designs are similar, but we have no concrete proof that they have similar origins, said an art history professor from the University of Paris-Sorbonne seated in the front row. Calla looked over to her right at the man next to her, desperate and needing to stay awake. He was nodding off and she was ready to leave. He flicked his eyes open and issued a gruff whisper. Look, everyone needs a break now. I sure as heck could use one after that last speaker. Calla's gut twisted as she felt the tinge of nausea running through her body. She was so beyond ready to go. If she hurried, she could make it to the National Archives in time. The drive would take her close to an hour down Chelsea Embankment, then toward the A4 motorway. With a glance at the clock on the wall, he tapped her frayed notebook. Shuffling her feet, she was ready to head out. Without hesitation, she seized her shoulder bag, straightened her khaki trousers, and slid on her coat. It was now or never. In the darkness, she rose. Almost on cue, the next presenter concluded, and the meeting chairman stepped behind the mic. We'll notify those who'll work on the Hadrius manuscript in Berlin. Some of you will receive a call. Calla barely heard the words. 6:50 p.m. Dark clouds above the London skyline echoed her thoughts. Calla checked the speedometer of her used Audi A3 hatchback. Filler hated lateness, but he owed Calla a favor. He'd made it easy for them to become friends when they met 5 years ago in a training course on smart technologies. Last January, she had translated a manual for Filler. He wanted to impress a woman he liked who worked at his local library. She remembered the hours she'd poured into the document. Thinking about her hard work, she shook her head. After several minutes, the automobile came to a traffic light. She rechecked the light as it turned green. The car ahead failed to move. She slammed the car horn. Come on. A voice boomed in the tiny space. 30 minutes later, her car pulled up in front of the National Archives building in the London suburb of Kew. Calla hurried through the main entrance. On Tuesdays, the offices stayed open until 7 p.m. Hands trembling, she checked her watch. A tired female voice came from the reception desk. We're closing in 10 minutes. Calla thanked her and scanned the lobby, pulling out her cell phone. There you are, a voice said. The receptionist relaxed her face as Filler trotted toward them. His black-rimmed glasses didn't hide the filler as he gestured for her to move through the glass barriers. She's with me. Sign her in as Miss Calla Cress. Filler, we're closing. No more visitors, the woman replied. She's my niece, he lied. I'll be responsible for her. The receptionist shook her head. I'll look the other way. Calla followed Filler, and they took the elevator to level 2. Once there, they moved down the hallway lit on one side by early moonlight peering through the glass facade. April had promised an early spring this year, and Calla's tension eased at the thought. Her 29th birthday would be soon. This year would be different. Calla would find them. Her parents. They stopped at a secure door that was missing a label. Filler produced a chain pass from his pocket and swiped the card reader, pushing the door open for Calla. This is a staff research room prohibited to the public. The computers here have unrestricted access to all known civil servant records. Click on the blue book icon and select civil records. The rest should be straightforward. He handed her a green post-it note. This is the password you'll need. Use it when prompted. I can give you 10 minutes maximum. He straightened his glasses. That gives me plenty of time to sign out, raising no suspicions. They'll assume I was checking the systems. Okay, I'll leave you to it. Filler switched on the fluorescent overhead lights and turned to leave. 10 minutes tops, he called as he walked out the door. She nodded. Thank you. The door shut behind him. Her skin radiated a chill, and the hairs on her arms stood on end. Calla shivered and hugged her elbows, feeling goosebumps rise. Her tongue felt heavy, her mouth parched. She licked her lips and tasted nothing but dust and stale air. It had to be close to 5 degrees Celsius in the room as she shook it off and moved toward the multi-screen computer on her desk. Hundreds of brown boxes piled together stood on grey steel shelves. Stacks of brown cardboard and yellow paper stank with the stench of plastic and wires. What the heck did they do in here? The archives were on the far side. She switched on the computer. Exactly as she had imagined, a secure socket layer of encryption protected it. A thin layer of tape wrapped around the primary drive, all but a thin band of clear plastic. Calla couldn't work around it, but punched in the details from Filler's post-it. The computer accepted her entry and lit a screen with 4 boxes. Calla chose the civil records icon as Filler had instructed. It was a considerable risk for him to let her use the restricted room, but she had only one name signed on her birth and adoption forms. Bonnie Tileman. If only she knew if her parents were dead or alive. She muttered under her breath, "All right. Just be ready for whatever you find." The computer churned and she pulled out the only form she'd ever seen on her adoption that came through a court in England. After several years of research, she'd contacted the General Registrar Office and requested the rights to get all records about her birth and adoption. A month ago, she'd needed every nerve to apply for a certificate of her original birth entry and her adoption certificate. The documents were incomplete, containing only what her biological parents had left before they disappeared. She had pored over the adoption form. It showed that she was adopted at 5 years of age. Calla fumbled through her bag for what she believed was her original birth certificate and studied it. Place of birth, County of Essex. Father's forename and surname unknown. Mother's forename and surname Bonnie Tileman. The name Bonnie Tileman had brought no concrete results. Could she find any link to her past? Calla had followed all avenues open to her, sometimes on ancestry websites, sometimes by grilling her evasive adoptive parents who had christened her Calla Lilycress. She'd taken the information to a private investigator 2 years ago, paying the more significant portion of her savings to locate Bonnie dead or alive. His investigation identified 2 women named Bonnie Tileman. The first had changed her name from Sarah Monet to Marla Cox several years before Calla's birth. The investigator's search also led to a civil registry, where he discovered the second registered as a civil servant. It took every ounce of technical knowledge she possessed to navigate through the complex software system. Though the software was foreign and new to her, like an old Cold War manual, the allure of it was both comforting and confounding. Calla continued studying the government encryption program. It had to work. After all, Jack had given her a quick lesson in operating the new smart tools such as the ones in front of her. He'd also given her a quick course in the latest database software that intelligence services were using. "You can even use them with just the irises of your eyes if you have permission," Jack had said. Calla slid her finger across the screen, working fast with one eye on the time. 7 minutes to go. Calla narrowed her eyes and focused on the glowing screen. The bright and colorful text of the catalog database was a confusing hodgepodge of numbers and letters. It reminded her of cryptograms she had seen in an ancient book. She stopped. A bold headline stared back at her. Civil Servant Commission 1800 present. The cursor blinked and she entered the name Marla Cox and waited a few seconds. 20 entries found. Damn, who do I pick? She glimpsed to the right of each listing, hoping for a period or date. None. What the heck? I have nothing to lose, she muttered. She hit the back icon and returned to the previous screen. Calla typed the name that had plagued her mind since the day she'd discovered it. Bonnie Tileman. Okay, she muttered. The cursor blinked, searching the database for information. When it stalled, Calla tapped her fingers on the desk. The machine failed to respond. A knock came from the outside. It was her 2-minute warning. Palms sweating, her muscles twitched, bringing on a feeling of nausea. She'd waited a long time. She knew enough about genealogy, DNA tests that determined a person's ethnicity, but she wouldn't go to these extremes. For now, she gave the dawdling computer a chance. Who had brought her to the foster home as a baby? Why? Why was there no record of them? Were her parents still alive? Perhaps they lived right here in London. Maybe in mainland Europe. Where had she inherited her skin, emerald amber eyes, dark hair and athletic physique? No one had ever told her. Could it be that her parents were Caucasian or of Asian, perhaps Latin American, French or even Indian descent? For all she knew, she could also be the product of mixed race from just about anywhere in the world. For her 29th birthday, Calla wanted answers. Search result. Finally, she said, exhaling. Over 200 entries found. Now what? She leaped from her chair as she hit the enter button several times. She glanced at the clock in the top right corner of her computer screen. With a click and a beep, a drop of sweat fell onto the silver surface of the desk. The high-pitched beep bounced from speaker to speaker, joining with the other beeps and chirps of the machine. She dropped a fist on the table. No, not now. Don't lock me out. Come on. The screen flashed a warning. You may not access this information. As Calla slid her fingers across the monitor, her efforts failed. The computer continued with its loud warning. A hand stretched over her shoulder and hit two function buttons. Phila's eyebrows knit. What did you do? He said, shutting off the machine. You raised the alarm. We've got to move. A systems security person could be here any minute. I'm afraid you must leave now. God knows I'm in enough trouble already. Please, Phila, this is my only chance. Phila sighed. With the soft gust, the world seemed to release its pressure. I can't, Calla. I'm sorry. The door flung open with a thud. A female data security manager with a tight grip on the doorknob blocked their only means of escape. She stormed into the room, followed by a male security guard. What's going on here? Just a routine checkup, Phila said. The woman's eyes fell on Calla. And she? Just a trainee. Let's go, the guard shouted. Calla picked up her belongings and rose, followed by Phila. I hope I didn't get you into trouble, she muttered to him. The male security guard approached Calla with a barrage of loud profanities. With a sloppy extension of his body, his hand gripped her by the arm and jostled her out of the building. Calla's eyes narrowed, her hair disheveled. Hey, it's public property, she called back. Her hands were moist and sticky. She wiped her brow raw and sore from the scuffle and sweat. She'd been so close.